We might have a few more people coming in, but that's okay. We'll just let them move on in. Welcome to the graveyard, the home straight. This is the Hard Yards of Conference, the last session. In my mind, at these moments, it's going to show my age. I think of the Chariots of Fire movie, Eric Liddell coming down the home straight. You know the moment where he lifts the head? Some of you nod, please. Tell me how old I am. Thank you. Lifts the head. Endorphin-filled energy, ready to surge the line with a burst of intellectual energy. Got it?
Yeah.
Got it? Okay. So, my name's Blair Exel. I look after the Development Policy Division in DFAT. So I'm actually reasonably, sometimes, every now and then, actually very interested in the topic of donor aid flows, policies and perception. I've been working in this space for at least 20-odd years, both inside and outside government, but the majority of my time inside government. And this is something I worry about a lot. So I was actually really pleased to be here to kind of listen firsthand and hear some of the comments and views from colleagues who will be talking today. I'm going to be employing the usual time tactics of brickbats and 4v2s, commonly known as time little pieces of paper with 2 minutes and five minutes. We're going to aim for 15 minutes for each speaker. That'll give us more time at the end for questions. Although I am conscious we started a bit late. In the tradition, or in the spirit of trying to minimise talking for myself, I'm going to kind of keep really introduction very, very short. So please consider all of the panellists eminently wise with great buckets of experience, and you should hang on every word that they say. So first of all, let me introduce Patrick Kilby. Patrick did want me to mention, of course, that this is part of a broader work he's doing around the story of aid, and that he's got a Fulbright scholarship for next year. I'll let him say where that is. So I'm going to give that. He asked me to specifically say that. So welcome, Patrick. Thank you.
What's even more interesting is I've got an East-West scholarship for this year, and how I got it is I put three words in the same sentence. So I knew it'd get me on the shortlist, and I was quite pleased. The three words were Trump, China, and foreign aid. Four words. So, and this comes to the story I want to talk about, is to where the foreign aid space is at. And I'm going to jump back in time, 40 years, to 1969, and then another 10 years, 79, for the Brandt and Pearson Commission. And I'm going to try to draw some parallels with where things are at now and where things were at then. And just by way of an aside, I was just very recently in Pakistan, in Karachi, and the front page of the newspaper on one day talked about a gas pipeline and technical assistance and a whole lot of stuff between, I think it's Turkmenistan and Pakistan. Okay? That, in the old parlance, would be a foreign aid project funded by the World Bank. And the next day, it talked about a $600 million budget support from China, following a $1.5 billion from Saudi the previous year. That would normally, in the old days, be part of the IMF's job to do that sort of lending. And so things are changing very rapidly. And so I want to talk about what happened in the past and then relate that to where we are now. Now, I rather like the term Aziz. I'd never heard of it except watching Rumpole of the Bailey. Which is, the court, the Aziz courts. But looking at the World Bank archives, which I spent some time last year, there's this reference to a grand Aziz. And so I had to look up what an Aziz was. And it was, a court in which the experts, the knights, would wander around the countryside and listen for the commoners and make judgments about what should happen. They performed the functions of a jury. and they were sent by a special commission from the Crown on circuits through the kingdom to present to take indictments and try to dispute disputed causes. And the idea of a grand disease looking at aid at the time was quite interesting. And so the Pearson Commission, to start with the idea actually came from George Woods, the head of the World Bank, which Robert McNamara took up very enthusiastically a few months later. And it was about the respect to the waning interest in development finance is serious and calls for new and unusual measures. And they wanted a Nobel Peace Prize committee to actually do this as a contribution for peace. The Nobel Peace Prize never did take it up, but the idea of having a Nobel Peace Prize winner being the head of the nobles to wander the world to take evidence was part of it. And so the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Lester Pearson, who was just immediately prior to that, in the mid-60s, was the Prime Minister of Canada. But he got his Nobel Peace Prize long before that for more international work. And I won't read the names out, So Arthur Lewis from Jamaica sounds an odd fit, and so whether he represents a developing country representative, we can question, but there's only one developing country person on it. And the World Bank paid for it. Okay, but the World Bank didn't make a big deal about paying for it. They wanted it to be quite independent. It was quite independent. And it looked at aid since the war. Okay, from the 20 years up till then. And the problem that was happening was that in the 1950s, the aid, foreign aid was very much a Cold War artefact. And it was the Soviets versus the West. The Soviet Union started providing aid, and Khrushchev, in one of his many colourful quotes, pointed out that the US should give the Soviet Union the credit for the increase in US aid, because it wouldn't have happened without the Soviets going into straight competition with them. And so it was very much competition. Now, the Soviets couldn't match the US in terms of volume, but they could match it in terms of strategic placement, such as the Aswan High Dam in Egypt, for example. And then around the same time, third world countries started to sort of voice their concerns. And so there's a Bandung conference in 1955 in Indonesia, which not only brought the non-aligned countries together, we brought the third world Soviet allies together and the third world US allies together, as well as the non-aligned. And so that was unique. And from it emerged the non-aligned movement, a whole lot of other things, but it really did send some shivers through Washington and other places, this idea that third world countries should have a voice. And Zhou Enlai from China featured at it, and he talked about increased Chinese cooperation with a Pan-Asia-Africa link. And he made a link with Nasser at the time, and the first Chinese aid went to Egypt shortly after that. And then in the mid-60s, Zhou Enlai made his big statement in Ghana with the eight principles of foreign aid, which the Chinese foreign aid program still sticks to. And so what we're seeing is a whole lot of voices emerging which essentially express a discontent with the way Western aid is going, World Bank and Western aid. And the non-aligned movement came up in the 60s, United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, etc. And the first development decade, which was a Kennedy idea, was meant to have foreign aid increased by 5% per annum and economic growth in developing countries increased by 5% per annum. Economic growth in most developing countries increased by at least 5%. Population growth brought that down in a per capita basis for a lot of countries to 2 to 3%. But some countries really did very well. Foreign aid fell in real terms over the decade. And so that caused much consternation. So the Pearson Commission, what it came up, was not a success. It was seen as asking for more of the same. The Pearson Commission was about generating political will through public opinion in rich countries, but it had a whole lot of rich country representatives speaking the voice. There's a small representative third world. The analysis was towards a simplified model of development. Unfortunately, we still have a simplified model of development, but we won't go there. Without the differentiation of particular needs, particular contexts, etc. And very optimistic presumptions as, no, we can do all this. It was largely ignored as the oil crisis hit as soon as it, just very shortly after it was released. Financial crisis when the US left the gold standard and that whole financial turmoil of the time. And the third world demanded a new international economic order. So essentially the whole foreign aid space fell into a rather chaotic situation. So then there was an idea of the Brandt Commission. And as these things, the origin of these things invariably start with a lunch. And the lunch was between Barbara Jackson, who was a baroness in the House of Lords in the UK, and Makbul ul Haq, who was senior vice president of the World Bank. And Makbul ul Haq took the view that he didn't have access to McNamara. When a lot of writers said McNamara said ul Haq was the only person he listened to, but ul Haq didn't believe that. So I wrote to William Cass to raise it with Bob, and so it was a new grand disease. We'll get the Dutch to pay for it. World Bank, arm's length. We ended up getting a majority of commissioners from developing countries. It said women, plural. There was one woman who was the, sorry, escapes my name, but she was the publisher of Time at the time. But still, the third world thought the commission was an attempt to wriggle out of the conference for international economic cooperation, to outflank the NEIO. So basically, where we're at is that both failed. Reagan came in just as the Brandt Commission report came out, and that the Reaganomics, Thatcherism, no time for the findings of Brandt. They did have meetings in many countries each, and you can see the details there. The Brandt Commission called for more international social justice and really focusing on debt, aid and trade. So I will skip the critiques, but you can see them there. But for a new disease, 30 years since Brandt, the world has seen the lost decade of the 1980s and the ideological focus, so the Washington Consensus and structural adjustment and ultimately its rejection. So the 80s and 90s, in a sense, they outflanked the new international economic order, but that battle wasn't won. The Asian economic crisis and the challenge to the credibility of the World Bank and IMF formula. Interesting, I just said that I opened the thing with a comment on Pakistan. Essentially, they went to neighbours for what is essentially an IMF loan and a World Bank loan. The rise of alternative sources of development finance, the BRICS, China, Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, and others. There is also the rise of more nationalist ideologies emerging, and we don't really have to list them all. We see them all on the front pages of the newspapers, to the point where there's a big inward look and a very chauvinistic view of the world, and whether it's Duterte in the Philippines, Trump in America, Erdogan in Turkey, we can just go on, the list goes on. So we have this situation where we're moving away from globalisation and global order to a whole lot of fragmented ideas. And so this a rhetorical question is, wouldn't it be great to have another grand disease? Except I don't think the world's sort of in the mood for it to the extent that it was in the 60s and 70s. The World Bank doesn't have the leadership anymore or any interest in trying to push a global order on foreign aid. It would be nice to have to have a broader discussion with developing countries, but is the DAC, Does it want to have a discussion about these things? Does it want to have a discussion with Turkmenistan about its aid to Pakistan? These are some questions. Of course, the other thing is, who would lead it? I'm trying to think of a Nobel Peace Prize winner who could lead it, which would be quite interesting. Barack Obama is the wrong gender, wrong nationality, probably the right colour. We could have... and a lot of the other people have shown, have blotted their copybook since. I was thinking maybe Amartya Sen. He could lead it. But is there a mood there? Would China really want to be part of that? And you couldn't have such an Aziz without including China in the room. And also, what about the other global powers? And in a sense, the new economic international order, which was wished for in the 70s, in a roundabout way has come to pass in the 2010s. And so the question is, in terms of foreign aid, do we want to have, should we have a conversation about what it looks like in this new world order, which is a world order that's struggling to be global in its focus in any way. It'd be nice to have it. I would like to see it for sure. And of course, the group would have to be 90% people from developing countries, half women, and maybe a token one or two from the West. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick, and really appreciate keeping to the time. Okay, we're going to keep going. Let me welcome to the podium Anthony and Harriet. So Anthony Swan, Harriet Conan. Anthony's research fellow with the Development Policy Centre, and Harriet's graduate student also with the Development Policy Centre, talking about foreign aid through the lens of newsprint media, a comparative analysis of Australia, New Zealand and the UK.
Right, thanks, Blair. Okay, so as Blair said, this research is with Harriet. So I'm going to kick it off. Harriet is going to present some of the results, and then I'll finish off. So those of you who were here yesterday would have heard Julie Bishop give very clear and deliberate messaging on aid. She talked about the role of aid and in sort of broader foreign policy objectives. She talked about why Australia gives aid, how it gives aid, and that it's designed to serve national interest. But the aid narratives that the general public receives are likely to be very different to this. Okay, we all source information from all different media outlets, for example, and so... when you think about the role of the media, it's going to amplify some messages and it's going to ignore others. So we're interested in aid narratives and we're going to focus on what newspapers, newsprint media, has to say about foreign aid. Okay, so, I mean, as we've heard, there's been a lot of dramatic changes in terms of foreign aid over the last few decades. So how can the average person in donor countries make sense of these changes? Well, it's important for donor governments, Julie Bishop, for example, to explain to the general public why these changes occur, but effective communication is not easy. The way that the media talks about foreign aid matters. For example, how often are aid issues reported on? And does reporting on aid talk about why we give aid, aid effectiveness, and the need for aid in recipient countries? Our focus is on shedding light on narratives of aid, and our data are articles, newspaper articles on aid, which are that over a 20-year period across four countries. So we ask the question, to what extent do aid narratives help build or hinder support for aid? There's some research questions. What are the prevalence of articles on aid? What are the main issues or topics on aid that are reported on in newspaper articles? And as I said before, how can aid narratives be strengthened to build and maintain support for aid? So how do we go about our research? Okay, so we analysed nearly 40,000 newspaper articles on aid. Okay, we sourced them from Factiva, which is a database, and our countries of focus are Australia, UK, New Zealand, and the US. So what we do is we search for particular phrases such as foreign aid, overseas aid, etc. And we also ensure that it includes the name of the home country in that search. Okay, so we come up with, well, actually 38,000 articles, and you can see at the bottom line here how they're spread over the four countries. Now, once we have all these articles, we use machine learning to discover what topics are being reported on in these aid articles. We can find out through our models the importance of these topics over time and how they are related to each other. So the particular approach we use is this is quite technical. It's called a structural topic model. It's fairly new, so I won't go into it in a great deal of detail, but you can sort of see some of its approach. But what we do is we estimate essentially 100 aid topics for each country, and then we can analyse them. So I'll pass it on to Herrick now, who will kick off some of the results.
Okay, so guys, I have a question for you to start off with. If I said I had 1,000 articles from an Australian newspaper or from Australian newspapers, how many do we think would be about aid?
One.
Okay. Any other guesses?
Two.
Ten? Two? Anyone else?
50. Less than one.
50? Less than one. Okay. You guys are actually the closest. The answer is 1.6.
Oh, I'm closer than that.
Yeah, well, whatever. Okay. And so what about if we're thinking about comparison, and what do you think about how many articles out of the 1,000 would be about defence? Any guesses?
100?
10? 30. Okay, you're pretty close, Rob. 37.8, so we're close. So we've got 1.6 for Australia for every 1,000 articles published in an Australian newspaper over the last 20 years. So defence is 24 times higher than the aid articles, which is like pretty important to think about for people in this audience who are wanting to build support for aid. So this graph just charts the average proportion of articles on aid in Australian newspapers. The orange line is slightly higher, that's Fairfax, and the green line that's slightly lower is the Murdoch papers. But we can see that there's peaks and troughs, but the trend is pretty flat. So we're looking at now on the right-hand side, we've got, the left-hand side for you guys. So we've got the UK and the US or have a sort of similar proportion to Australia. The New Zealand articles are a little bit lower, but we think that this is probably because New Zealand newspapers are a little bit more local and tend to focus a bit more on local issues. For the US, Australia, New Zealand, we've all got pretty flat trends, but you can see here that the UK has a clear sort of increasing trend there. And we think that this is probably since about 2007, and it's coming, we can see that it's largely driven by the tabloids, and it's coming sort of in line with the increase in the aid budget in the UK. So it's interesting to think about. So we're going to go into our results now. So for the Australian corpus, we've estimated a 100 topic model, which shows what aid topics are being reported on in Australian newspapers. And these topics are made of words that tend to co-occur the most frequently within articles. So on the left, we've got a selection of interesting topics. And we've given these topics names based on the words that have a high probability of being in that topic. and on reading newspaper articles that have the highest association with the topic. So this Howard foreign policy topic is about John Howard's foreign policy. The line lengths show how each topic, show how the topics vary over size. So the Howard topic takes up about 3% of the corpus. Given that this is a 100-topic model, we expect, on average, 1% of each topic. So to the right, we've got a chart of the headlines of the most relevant articles in the 8 support value topic. We use these headlines to come up with labels for the topic, so this is how we decided that this topic was called Support for Aid. And you can see that they're all about support for aid. Okay, so this is our topic network graph. This is the bit from the handout if you want to reference it. So what we can draw out from this graph is that the narrative on what the aid program is for and how it links to Australia's broader foreign policy suffers from a bit of a lack of coherence. So this network map, each node represents an individual topic, and we've got the labels on there for you guys. The size of the node is proportional to the size of the topic in the corpus, so you can see that the Howard topic is the biggest again. Topics are connected to other topics based on the correlation between them, so thicker connections represent higher correlations, so the aid cuts and the budget deficit topic here, they're very highly correlated, and we expect that words that are associated with aid cuts and budget deficit would tend to co-occur in the same articles together. For simplicity, the map is disregarding really weak relationships between the topics. So the colours represent the likelihood of the word aid being mentioned in each topic, and as they get warmer, they are talking about aid more. So this support for aid topic down here is the most aid-related topic. I'm going to zoom in now and take you around the map a little bit more. So down here we can see we've got a cluster of sort of aid-related topics. Down here we've got some sort of need for aid, there's aid effectiveness, aid reviews, and then up here it comes into the sort of economic policy. So we've got a budget deficit, policy, aid cuts, and then we're heading into a sort of political cluster up to the side here. If we move up, we can see we've got sort of, we're talking about regional engagement here, and these topics are all quite linked together. Over to the side, if I can move them. We've got private sector, up the top, sort of conflict, and then quite separate, we've got a disaster topic, a refugees topic, disease, and a separate aid donation topic. So I guess the interesting stuff to pull out of this, I'll zoom back out. So we'll go back. So the reporting on regional political and economic engagement is quite weakly linked to reporting on why and how we give aid. The disaster, the conflict, the regional sort of economic stuff is really quite isolated from the broader aid debate. We can see that it's really clustered down the bottom here. And we've also got aid cuts is kind of talked about in relation to economics and politics rather than about why we give aid or how we give aid or aid effectiveness or the need for aid. So here we have taken this heat map approach to politicians. So we find low levels of reporting on CAR and RUD in topics focused on justifying aid, despite the fact that they presided over the budget ramp-ups for the aid. Reporting on Bishop and Abbott is focused on aid cuts and the budget, but Bishop is also quite prominent in the support for aid cluster that we saw down the bottom. So we produced these heat maps. They show like the extent to which politicians are reported on across different topics. And I guess the interesting thing to note here is that under Carr and Rudd, we didn't see much discussion about support for aid. They're not mentioned in those topics at all. And we think that it's possible that because they ramped up the aid budget but didn't really talk about support for aid, it was a lot easier for the Abbott government to then cut aid and justify it effectively.
But not gender.
Yeah, so Julie Bishop is not present in the gender topic at all.
Which means she both supports it, but not publicly, basically.
Well, it's not supported. So this is just a time plot of the topic proportions. We see higher reporting on support for aid during the Howard and Downer era cuts, but that this really drops off with the return of the coalition government and the cuts in 2014. And now I'm going to hang up to Tony to talk about the other countries.
Okay, thanks, Harriet. So
now let me be a bit more clear on the UK, US, and New Zealand results. So here, once again, you see the topic map, network map for the UK. And I guess, compared to Australia, reporting on key aid issues, such as the aid targets, which is a very big debate in the UK, why and how aid is given, is more strongly linked to reporting on the need for aid, disaster relief, and the private sector. So we saw in Australia, reporting on disasters is completely separate from these sort of key issues on aid. So in the UK, it's much more closely linked. Reporting on politics is also somewhat distant from reporting on aid targets. So at the top left, it's hard to see. Some of you have handouts. But that's about politics, and it's quite far removed from the discussion on aid topics. So I guess from that perspective, perhaps this is an area where aid narratives can be strengthened. Another feature is that reporting in the UK on aid waste, and aid waste is the big red node at the top right there, is a big deal in the UK, and reporting on corruption, which is next to it, and aid budgets, are weakly linked to reporting on why the UK gives aid or how effective it is, which is down in this area. Okay, now we can produce the same topic network, but then the heat map is now, where it's showing blue, it's where broadsheets are more reporting on this topic compared to tabloids. And the red is where the tabloids are reporting more on that topic than the broadsheets. So you can see, for example, at the top right, that aid and waste is dominated by tabloid reporting. Aid targets down here on aid effectiveness development, economics and poverty is all broadsheets. So I guess from that perspective, we find that aid narratives in the UK are quite fragmented across those two dimensions. We believe that readers of tabloid newspapers in the UK are receiving perhaps a one-sided view on aid issues, for example, aid and waste. So just homing in a bit on this aid and waste topic, we've plotted it over time, and that's the red lines. These are confidence intervals, by the way. So just look at the middle one. That's the aid and waste, and the blue is for aid budgets, and you can see they're highly related to each other, ramping up very much in line with the UK aid budget. So if you want to understand aid narratives a bit more, we can look at, well, who's reporting on aid and waste? So that's what this one is showing, and it shows that tabloids have gone from zero reporting on this and have ramped up at a much faster rate than broadsheets. Just quickly with the US, I'm not going to go into it, but I just want to say that aid narratives in the US appear to be more balanced compared to Australia. It's much more interlinked. And also another thing which that the reasons for giving aid are much closely linked to each topics around conflict and peace. Similarly, for the New Zealand topic map, it's quite interlinked. These are all aid-related issues relating to why they give aid, the need for aid, disasters, NZ aid reforms. So once again, it is is more balanced compared to Australia. So just finishing up, we have a few discussion points here. One is that what we've provided is a long-term perspective, 20 years' worth. So the particular aid narratives that Julie Bishop is trying to bring about is only going to play a small role in this, what we've presented. Also, there is a difference between aid messaging and the way media reports on aid messaging. So, are donor governments and other stakeholders providing clear and coherent messaging on aid, but the media is just not reporting on it? Or is it the case that aid messaging by stakeholders could be improved through better communication strategies? And our last point, and it does sound a bit cheesy, is that we see a need for champions of aid to step up and shine a light on certain aid issues, aid and waste, for example, to put it to bring in other ideas about why we give aid, how we give aid, aid effectiveness, and that sort of thing. So yes, it could be types like Bono and Geldof, but just more broadly, we think that would help interlink aid issues better. And just thinking about the tabloid broadsheet fragmentation, that these champions, they shouldn't be preaching to the converted. They need to be engaging with people that read different types of newspapers, for example. So that's it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anthony and Harriet. I don't know about others, but I had a sweat through that presentation. Some of that was very real. In fact, I actually remember a journalist saying to a minister, I will break you on the aid program in Australia in the not too distant past. So it is very real, and it is, gets quite personal. Final session, Matthew Dornan, Terence Wood and Camilla Burcott. I think Matthew's not here, so it's just Terence and Camilla. Again, all from the ANU. What Australian aid flows show. Thanks.
Get this to show up.
Didn't push.
Just change it back.
It's on theatre PC.
No, we're going to have to act this one out. So, here at the Development Policy Centre, obviously we've been trying to gauge and plot the changing nature of Australian aid for a number of years using a range of different methods. Some of these have been qualitative, commentary, for example. Others have been quantitative, the stakeholder survey. What we're going to do today is report on a new project that we've embarked upon. This is a project where we've attempted to make use of publicly available information on the Australian Government Aid Program, both to track changes in aid over time and also to situate the Australian Government Aid Program amongst other donors within the OECD. It's a project, it's a work in progress, so you're just going to get a sort of teaser in this presentation, but it will end up leading to discussion papers and blog posts, which we'll produce later in the year. We'll start with a story that I think is probably familiar to all of you. This is the tale of Australian aid flows and Australian aid generosity over time. This chart's got two different lines on it, one associated with the blue shaded area, plots Australian aid in absolute terms over time from the early 1970s until the end of the 2015-16 financial year. And this tells a story that I like to call Australia Climbs the Matterhorn. So for a long time, you see Australia stumbling around here in the foothills, and then bang, all of a sudden, just after the turn of the millennium, Australia starts really increasing its aid in absolute terms. It starts on a trajectory towards becoming a significant global aid power. Except, alas, in 2013, hits the peak of the Matterhorn, and whoa, slides down the other side. And that's what we can see on the right-hand side of the chart. The other line, the red line, is a little bit different, difficult to come up with a sort of catchy term for it, but maybe the roller coaster ride. And this is Australian aid as a share of GNI, the standard measure of generosity. What we can see is that Australia has become a wealthier country over time. Aid volumes really haven't kept up, or hadn't kept up for a long time. And so Australian aid as a share of GNI was dropping until once again we get to about the turn of the millennium and at that point in time, Ada's share of GNI really increases until at last the roller coaster reaches the crest of its ride and then bang, down the other side. So this is a story that you're probably all familiar with. The one thing that we really want to add to this discussion is that we've inserted here changes in government with the yellow lines. And the really interesting thing is that be we talking about declines or be we talking about increases, at least until very recently, there's been very little difference between the Labour government and the coalition. So we can see aid coming down as a share of GNI, both under Labour governments and under the coalition. Then we can see a period where aid increases as a share of GNI, both under Labour governments and under the coalition. Of course, it's the coalition who brought about this really precipitous drop at the end of the story, but the Labour government, Labour opposition at present, certainly isn't talking about reversing that state of affairs. So there's an interesting point there. Whatever it is that drives changes in the Australian aid budget, it certainly isn't as simple as partisan politics. That's not to say that politics doesn't matter for aid, but it doesn't have a simple relationship when it comes to overall aid volumes. So having talked about overall volumes, now let's have a look at parts of the world that receive Australian aid. Here we've got a chart that spans from the turn of the millennium until the end of the 16-17 financial year. It's an area chart. Each of the areas on the chart corresponds to a part of the world that receives Australian aid. The main thing that I want to emphasise in this chart is the bottom sector, which is the Pacific. And over this period of time, the Pacific's either been the largest or the second largest recipient of Australian aid. And the most important thing, though, to note about the Pacific is the Pacific really didn't share in the boom very much in absolute terms, but nor did it suffer from the cuts. So compared to what happened to the rest of the world, the Pacific has had a relatively smooth ride over the last decade and a half. Speaking of the rest of the world, we've got two charts here that give us a sense of who won and then who lost during the ramp-up and then scale-back of Australian aid budgets. The different colour lines on this chart reflect different parts of the world. The one that we're really interested in here is the Middle East and Africa, the purple line. And what the line shows is Australian aid volumes that go into this region relative to the amount this region got in the year 2000. And there's an obvious story there, right? At one point in time, the Middle East and Africa was a big winner, but all of a sudden, it lost almost all of its gains, although it's still somewhat better off vis-a-vis the turn of the millennium. We removed the Middle East and Africa so that the y-axis of the subsequent chart expands, and we can see there's a fairly similar story there to be told about South and West Asia. Once again, a big gain there as the aid programs sort of ramped up, and also a subsequent loss. So those are the parts of the world whose fortunes really changed with the recent ramp-up in Australian aid and then scale back. That brings me to fragmentation. So fragmentation, when we talk about fragmentation, we're talking about the way any donor breaks up its aid across recipient countries. Generally in the aid world, I guess everything else being equal, having a highly fragmented aid program is considered a bad thing. This is because you give aid to too many countries, you raise your own administration costs, you also raise the transaction costs, and you lose out on the chance to specialise and gain knowledge of a smaller number of recipients. And I've measured fragmentation here in two different ways on this chart, based on DFAT data, starting from the mid-1970s, running to the end of the 2015 financial year, which is the most recently available data on the DFAT chart. The red line here is simply fragmentation measured by the number of countries that Australia gives aid to. We can see quite a lot of fluctuation there, but there's a broad upwards trend. Australia has been giving aid to more and more countries over time. Of course, the problem with simply counting the number of recipient countries is that if you do that, you're treating large recipients and small recipients alike. And that's not really a very good gauge of fragmentation, because obviously a country that is a recipient of a large share of your aid budget is going to be a more substantive sort of drain at the donor end than a country that only gets a few sort of $1,000 via the scholarship program or whatever. So to correct for that, what I've created here with the blue line is a Herfindahl-Hirschman fragmentation index. Herfindahl always sounds to me like a character from Lord of the Rings, but I presume he was an economist. He came up with a fragmentation index, and so did Albert Hirschman. And What this index does, and it's a standard measure used in the aid literature, is it takes the number of countries, but then it weights recipients as per the share of the donor aid budget that they get. So larger countries now count for more, smaller countries count for less. Unfortunately, the Herfindahl-Hirschman index is sort of inverted vis-a-vis the number of countries. But what we're seeing here is not a trend of improvement, the downward line. We're actually seeing a trend of increased fragmentation as gauged by this measure too. There's a couple of things worth noting about the blue line. The first is that once upon a time, Australian aid was amazingly concentrated. And this is in the mid to late 1970s. And this is because although Australia gave aid to a reasonable number of countries back then, it gave almost all of its aid to one recipient, Papua New Guinea. The other thing to note is that while DFAT data don't let me estimate the impact of the 2015-16 cuts, or estimate the impact of the 2015-16 cuts on fragmentation, OECD data, which themselves are kind of imperfect for the task, suggest that cuts did bring with them a decrease in fragmentation, although it wasn't that dramatic. So that's the story of fragmentation over time. How about fragmentation? How does Australia compare to other donors? Well, when we compare Australia to other OECD DAC donors, by looking at the number of recipient countries, we find that Australia is one of the worst donors in the DAC. Only four other donor countries give aid to more recipients than Australia does. However, if we look at the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, we find that Australia is one of the best donors in the DAC. Only five countries are less fragmented by this measure. What explains this paradox? Basically, the explanation is Australia gives very small amounts of aid to a lot of countries, and it focuses most of its aid on just two countries, Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. There are some other countries that fall in between, like Solomon Islands, but they're not very numerous. And so that's why we can get a really bad score on one measure and a really good score on the other. Intriguingly, Australia is quite unusual in this sort of pattern. Most countries that give aid to a lot of countries also have very high levels of aid fragmentation. Over to you.
So now I'm going to talk a little bit about sectoral spending and sectoral spread of Australian aid. That is the different types of work that Australian aid program is funding. This shows spending by sector according to OECD data for 2015, which is the most recent year available. You can see here that, I don't know how well you can read it from the back, but other takes up about 32%. And in Australia's case, that is largely multi-sector cross-cutting activities. After that, government and civil society is the next largest, then economic development, 14%, education, 12%, health, 9%, humanitarian, almost 9%, and then there's a range of other sectors. And one of the reasons I wanted to start with this is because we wanted to try to think a little bit about the extent to which the government is funding activities under its stated priorities and how Australia compares to other donors in terms of allocating money to those priorities. So this table shows where Australia ranks compared to the other OECD DAC countries in 2015, according to the proportions, not the absolute amounts. And so a ranking of 1 would be the biggest spender. 28 would be the smallest by proportion. So here you can see Australia does quite well. Government and civil society, only the Netherlands, Denmark, and Slovak Republic spend more. And at the other end, we're not doing so well compared to other DAC countries on humanitarian response and environment. And I'm just going to look a little bit more closely at economic development because that has been quite a big priority and quite talked about quite a lot by the present government. This graph shows economic development spending as a proportion of total ODA in 2015, again from the OECD. And I should note the OECD grouping for economic development is economic infrastructure and services, including transport and storage, communications, banking and finance, business, as well as production sectors, agriculture, industry, mining, construction, trade policies and regulations, and tourism. So it's quite a broad spread. So as you've seen, as I noted in the previous slide, Australia spends about 14% of the budget. It's middle of the pack. Japan and Korea over time have consistently been the biggest spenders on economic development. If we look over time for Australia, so the blue line is showing the percent of the aid budget, again, according to OECD data, spent on economic development, and the red is the ranking on the right side. So we can see that the proportion of the aid budget spent on economic development has been increasing since the coalition came into government in 2013, certainly higher than it was back in 2006. It still makes up a smaller proportion of the aid budget than it did at the turn of the millennium. So we're still, compared to other countries, still more or less sitting in the middle of the pack, but we're not nearly as highly ranked as we were back in the early 2000s. But certainly the aid budget has increased since then. And I think the other thing that's important to think about that this data doesn't tell us about is, the quantity of spend doesn't necessarily tell us anything about quality and what activities are actually going to and whether we're spending more efficiently or targeting in better ways. So that's sort of an open question that this information can't tell us too much about, though we are still looking forward to seeing the 2016 data when it becomes available to see if that sort of uptick in 2015 continues on. The next sector or cross-cutting area really we want to talk about is gender. Gender equality and women's empowerment, which again is a big priority for the aid program. Again, this data is OECD. There's changes in the reporting protocol, means we can only go back a few years. We can see in this, what this chart shows is the proportion of bilateral sector allocable aid that falls into these different categories. So the light blue is the share of aid in which gender equality is important and deliberate, but not the principal objective. The dark blue is where gender equality is the principal objective of that aid. And so the thing that I think stands out here is that there's no real clear trend in increase. It's stayed pretty much on a flat line, which, as I mentioned, sort of stands out in contrast to the political rhetoric around this issue, particularly with the minister. So that's over time for Australia. If we look comparatively to other OECD countries, if we sort the donors by the principal category, the dark blue, which is what you see here, Australia ranks 10th, which is better than the median, above the mean. So it's not one of the best donors, but it does pretty well. If we rank these where gender equality was principal or significant focus, then we end up the sixth. Australia's the sixth best donor. So I think it's fair to say that we are regarded as a fairly good donor. And I think it's also important just to note that Australia does rank quite well in terms of actually screening its aid for gender. There's some countries where they just don't screen a lot of the aid. So it's important that that's even on the radar. The last thing that I'm getting the stop sign, so I'll stop soon. But the last thing we just wanted to look at very quickly is spending on what's often referred to as overheads or departmental expenses. And I think this is worth looking at because it's often something that is kind of pointed to as a easy thing to cut. If you're looking to cut the aid budget, that seems like a convenient sort of place to go. So this shows the absolute amount, the blue bars, and then the share of the total ODA. And what you can see quite clearly is there was a big scale-up when the aid budget was scaling up, and then quite a dramatic cut in the 2014-15 budget, which I understand is the same year there was a 5% cap put on departmental expenses. Since then, they seem to be coming back up again. And across all the OECD countries, 5% is about the average. But there's no real rules around what is too much or too little. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that some of the other research that we've done at Deb Policy, including the AID Stakeholder Survey, the things that have come out as areas for improvement are things that do require administrative spend. It's a lot of money, but it can be money that's very well spent in terms of managing the rest of the aid program. So that, with that, I will quickly wrap up and put in a quick plug for our A-Tracker. If you haven't seen it, you can go explore more data. As Terence mentioned, we're looking forward to expanding this analysis as we go forward and as more data becomes available. And look forward to discussing with you all.
So well.